Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder, by Ivor Davis. Narrated by Matthew Waterson. Assignment Murder. Tip the world over on its side, and everything loose will land in Los Angeles. Frank Lloyd Wright. In 1969, I was the West Coast correspondent of the London Daily Express, one of the most widely read newspapers in Europe, with an impressive 4 million readers a day. I was a one-man bureau, headquartered in West Los Angeles, and my job was a foreign correspondent's paradise. Never a dull moment, never a slow day, never a shortage of lively or provocative assignments, or sunshine for that matter. But in August of that year, the world, and particularly Southern California, was shocked beyond belief by a series of events that petrified residents in an affluent Los Angeles neighborhood. The illusion that their luxurious homes were insulated from commonplace crime was well and truly shattered. From the moment the series of savage murders exploded onto the front pages of newspapers around the world in early August 1969, I jumped on the case, did my own sleuthing, and learned more than anyone ever wanted to know about the Charles Manson family. I became intimately familiar with all the gruesome details of the carnage and what they were capable of. The moment Manson was identified as the architect of the killings, I went to a courthouse in Inyo County, California, on the edge of Death Valley, where he was being held. Then to the Spahn Ranch, in Los Angeles's sprawling San Fernando Valley, where they lived. And I began interviewing family members. Much to my surprise, many of the leftover members who had not been arrested or indicted for murder were still sacking out on a sea of ratty old mattresses on the tarpaulin-covered dirty floor of a fake and decaying Western Saloon bar. And they were just dying to spill their guts. While they were mostly silent about the murders, they offered vivid stories, detailing chapter and verse, the lifestyle that culminated in the bloodbath of 7 innocent people on 2 awful nights. Even as a seasoned reporter, I had a hard time separating fact from fiction. With my seen-it-all cynical editors 6,000 miles away in London screaming for stories, and with deadlines to meet, I filed a series of tales that caused those hardened editors of mine on London's Fleet Street to question the veracity of my outlandish narratives. 9 months later, I wrote 5 to Die, the first book about the infamous murders, which was published 3 months before the trial began. It was a damning indictment of Manson and his mindless followers. It laid out in graphic detail for the very first time the bizarre lifestyle, the drugs, the orgies, and the violence, which had become the daily routine of that raggle-taggle band of young men and women who were worshipping at Manson's feet. And it detailed Manson's most outrageous and fiendish gospel, served up with regular doses of assorted psychedelic drugs fed to them daily, claiming that the lyrics to songs on the Beatles' 1968 White Album, specifically Helter Skelter, were secret messages to Charlie and only Charlie. The gospel, according to Manson, declared that the Beatles were warning of a coming racial Armageddon, which the family would survive by fleeing on a flotilla of dune buggies to a secret refuge in Death Valley, California, where they would live happily ever after. In my mind, it was total unadulterated garbage, absolute poppycock for the delusional Manson to interpret the Beatles' lyrics in the way he supposedly did. While I am in no way a musicologist, by pure chance I was extremely familiar with the Beatles, their music, and their lyrics. In 1964, I traveled with them on their first North American tour and saw them again in 1965 when they returned to the USA. I knew with absolute certainty that there was no subliminal warning of a black-and-white conflagration hidden in their songs. In 5 to Die, I didn't hold back castigating Manson's demented worshippers for following a diabolical madman. Not surprising, this did not endear me to the remnants of Manson's crackpot army of young women who were to keep a year-long vigil outside the Los Angeles courthouse. They had all pledged to remain loyal to their ruler forever and do whatever was necessary until Charlie walks out a free man. And whatever was necessary, I quickly discovered, was pretty chilling. I will never forget my brief encounter with Manson devotee Lynette Squeaky Frommy when I saw her squatting on the street outside the courtroom on the first day of the trial in July 1970. She recognized me right away. We had talked at the Spahn Ranch 7 months earlier, and now my book, which painted Manson and his gang as a depraved band of killers, had been published. She greeted me with a friendly wave and an angelic smile. "Hi, Ivor," she called out, in that sing-song, butter-wouldn't-melt-in-a-mouth, emotionless voice. "Do you know what it feels like to have a razor-sharp knife slid down your throat?" Her comment sent shivers down my spine. I didn't respond. No quip or rebuttal readily came to mind, so I quickly moved past her into the courthouse. My sojourn into the lifestyle and inner workings of the family grew, as weeks turned into months and then years. Manson and his mob just wouldn't go away. My pursuit of the story was to sweep me up on a strange and unique personal odyssey that stretched over almost half a century. As time went by and the threat subsided, the trials came and went. The case continued to obsess me like no other story I have ever encountered. I could not rid myself of those ghastly images. I carefully followed the circuitous trail of those convicted of the killings after spending almost a year covering the trial. I revisited the case, interviewing leading players in California, London, and Paris. My unending assignment took me through a house of horrors. A journey that began with the destruction of the innocent lives of the pregnant actress, Sharon Tate, fashionable Hollywood hairstylist, Jay Sebring, and their friends had a mansion hidden away on Cielo Drive off Benedict Canyon, and then a day later moved to a Los Angeles residential neighborhood, where the lives of Los Angeles businessman Leno LaBianca and his wife Rosemary were senselessly cut short. There were other corpses strewn along the path as well. Some who died, innocents whose lives were forever scarred beyond repair by those heinous two nights. The internationally acclaimed movie director, the rock legend, the Hollywood superstar, the music industry giant. Feel free to come along on this journey with me. Part 1. The Crime. 1. The Killings. I felt absolutely nothing for her as she begged for her life and the life of her baby. There was nothing I could do, no turning back. It was like I was caught in something I had no control over. It was like I was a tool in the hands of the devil. Susan Atkins, 1976 ABC TV interview. The swirling hallucination of the 60s had climaxed in the ultimate summer bummer, and it all made a grotesquely twisted sense. Barney Hoskins, Waiting for the Sun, Strange Days, Weird Scenes, and The Sound of Los Angeles, 1996. Saturday, August 9th, 1969, was undoubtedly the most horrifying day in Winifred Winnie Chapman's life. The sun was trying hard to burn through the early morning Los Angeles haze as the 55-year-old housekeeper stepped off the bus at Santa Monica Boulevard and Cannon Drive in Beverly Hills. Those early morning buses were often called the maids' specials, because housekeepers, cooks, and babysitters would leave at sunrise to travel the 20-odd miles to serve affluent Westside families. The trip from her home on East 46th Street in South Central LA took about 45 minutes. As she stepped off the bus shortly before 8 o'clock a.m., Chapman caught sight of a familiar face. It was a friend of her employer's, the Polish-born film director Roman Polanski, and his 8 months pregnant wife, actress Sharon Tate. The couple was renting a ranch-style barn red house in remote Benedict Canyon, surrounded by pine trees, lawns, and well-manicured shrubbery. The Dream House had been built in 1941 by the French actress Michelle Morgan, and it had previously been home to actors Henry Fonda and Cary Grant, as well as record producer Terry Melcher, son of Doris Day, and Melcher's actress-model girlfriend Candice Bergen. At $1,500 a month, it was the perfect property for showbiz people seeking privacy. Indeed, the Benedict Canyon area had been a popular hotspot through the years. Rudolph Valentino once had a home there, as did Doris Duke, the tobacco heiress. And just a few doors away was Joseph Stefano, screenwriter for the chilling landmark movie Psycho and close friend of Alfred Hitchcock. Chapman had been looking after the Polanski housekeeping needs for more than a year and was equally as thrilled as Tate to watch the spare bedroom being turned into a nursery. The Polanski's Good Samaritan friend offered Chapman a ride to the gated house, some 2 miles up the road on an easy-to-miss side street off Benedict Canyon Drive. The address was 10050 Cielo Drive. She gratefully accepted the offer. It saved her cab fare. Minutes later, shopping bag in hand, the slender housekeeper who some said resembled singer Eartha Kitt, and who was affectionately called Winnie Pooh by the white families in the San Fernando Valley where she earned extra money doing nanny duties, walked briskly up the driveway to the estate gate. She pushed the button, and the gate immediately opened. She noted a broken telephone wire hanging above the house, but assumed it had been felled by the wind. She picked up the morning copy of the Los Angeles Times from the red mailbox and hurried to the house. Even with the quicker-than-normal bus ride and car lift, she was still tardy for work, and Chapman didn't like being late. She noted a car in the driveway, a white Rambler, which she didn't recognize as belonging to the Polanskis or to their long-term house guests. She was, however, familiar with a black Porsche, which belonged to Tate's friend, Beverly Hills hairstylist Jay Sebring, a frequent visitor at the house. Though the Rambler looked odd and out of place, jutting out half sideways in the driveway as if hurriedly parked, she barely gave it a second glance as she hurried to the front door. I snapped out the outside lights, which someone had left on, unlocked the back door and went in, she was to hauntingly recount later to a Los Angeles grand jury. I went to the kitchen phone and picked it up. It was dead. Since our electric was on, I surmised it was the telephone wires that had fallen. Then I started up front to waken someone. That is when I saw the bodies and the bloody clothes and what have you. She stepped inside and froze. All around her were unrecognizable bodies looking artificial, like mannequins covered in blood strewn around the house. It was a scene straight out of a horror movie. Only this was real. Paralyzed by fear, she felt faint. Her heart began to palpitate. She could hear it pounding. And then she began screaming. Murder! Murder! She screamed as she ran back down the driveway to get help at the next-door neighbor's house. She hammered her small fists on the front door until her hands began to hurt. Call the police! Murder! She shrieked again and again to no one in particular. There's blood! Bodies everywhere! No reply. She raced to a second house further down the hill, still howling, her brain spinning wildly, unable to comprehend what she had witnessed just moments earlier. At the lower house on Cielo, 15-year-old Jim Assen, a member of the local law enforcement troop 800 Boy Scouts, part of a police-sponsored troop, was standing in the driveway. He calmly alerted his father, Ray. They phoned the West Los Angeles police station, in whose jurisdiction Cielo Drive fell. The teenager shrewdly noted the time was 8:33 a.m. Then the Assens did their best to try to calm the hysterically sobbing woman, but she was inconsolable and collapsed on the floor in a heap. Minutes later, six squad cars, sirens wailing, came racing up the narrow, winding canyon road, screeching to a halt at the half-opened Cielo Drive estate gate. It was like a battlefield, one of the uniformed officers was later to remark. There was a bullet-riddled young guy in the Rambler, another man with no face left, on the lawn in the back of the house, and just a few feet away, another body, a barefooted woman, further down on the grass. They sent out an urgent call for homicide detectives and, guns drawn, carefully entered the house. Who knew if the killers might still be lurking somewhere? There was no sign of life anywhere on the grounds, but suddenly the officers heard barking from the guest house. Three of the officers, Jerry Joe DeRosa, William Wisenhunt, and Robert Burbridge, cautiously approached. There were noises and definite movement inside, just steps from the lawn and the boulder-lined swimming pool area. Then more barking. Was the killer hiding? A decision had to be made, so they smashed down the front door. A barking Weimaraner leapt at one of the cops, then from behind the dog stepped a skinny, young, bare-chested man with a thick mop of curly black hair, looking as though he had just gotten out of bed. He was still rubbing sleep out of his eyes as the three officers pointed a rifle, a shotgun, and a pistol into his chest. He seemed totally confused, facing the heavy artillery gun barrels pointed just inches from his flesh. The young man identified himself as William Garretson. He was 19 and had been hired as a resident caretaker by the owner of the property, Rudy Altobelli. Altobelli was manager to a slew of stars, including Henry Fonda, Katharine Hepburn, and newcomer British actress Samantha Egger. Garretson explained that he lived in the guest house with three of Altobelli's dogs, while the owner was away in Europe on business. Aldobelli had purchased the estate for $86,000 in the early 60s because he fell in love with what he called the property's magical views, which on a clear day stretched all the way to Santa Monica and the Pacific Ocean. But because he travelled extensively on business, he frequently rented the main house out to showbiz tenants. When he was home, he lived in the guest house. It was an idyllic setup, until Helter Skelter was unleashed. The police took no chances. They handcuffed the terrified Garretson, then frog-marched him over to the back garden lawn and to the bodies of the man and woman. "Do you know them?" "Who are they?" snapped Wizenhunt. Garretson was barely able to fix his eyes on the mutilated corpses. He was scared out of his wits, possibly hungover. He wasn't making much sense, mumbling almost incomprehensibly. The woman, he said, looked like Winnie Chapman, the Polanski's housekeeper. Or maybe not, he couldn't be sure, and the male could be a relative or friend of Roman Polanski. He was certain of nothing. He said that he had been home in the guest cottage all night long, listening to the doors on headphones, and that he finally fell asleep somewhere around 5:30 a.m. He had tried to make a phone call to check the time, but the phone had no dial tone. Almost like a mantra, he kept repeating that he had heard nothing until the cops kicked his door down. Despite his insistence that he was innocent, Garretson was carted off to jail. It gave him no comfort when, while being booked, he overheard an officer say, "There's the guy who killed all those people in Beverly Hills." Intuitively, the cops working the investigation doubted he was a killer. Still, he looked like he was coming off a bad drug trip, leading them to surmise that maybe some of his hippie friends might be responsible. On Cielo Drive, more LAPD officers had arrived at the scene, many off-duty and still in plain clothes. They fanned out, grimly searching every inch of the meticulously landscaped property for any piece of evidence that might reveal what had gone down. Cautiously, with guns drawn, several inched toward the main house where they were to find two more bodies butchered, even more heinously than those already found on the lawn. The warm afternoon sun bounced off the sparkling blue-tiled swimming pool water. Just a few feet away, the automatic pool cleaner hummed quietly, as if it were just another day in paradise. Within hours, a new army of LAPD homicide detectives descended. One of them, Michael McGann, vividly remembers everything he saw. For an oral history of the murders given to Los Angeles magazine writer Steve Oney, he described what he had seen. There was a car parked in the middle of the driveway, and there was a body in the car. That was Stephen Parent. He was slumped over to the side on the front seat. He'd been shot 3 times. As I approached the house, I noticed that the word pig was written in what appeared to be blood on the front door. Then I went inside. Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring were lying on the living room floor, both with multiple stab wounds. A rope was tied around Sharon's neck and draped over a rafter. The other end of the same rope was affixed to Jay Sebring's neck. They were probably about 4 feet apart. Sharon was in a bikini-style nightie. She was 8.5 months pregnant, and I could tell she'd been stabbed 15+ times. Sebring had been stabbed and beaten over the head. There was blood everywhere. I went through the house and down a long hallway leading out to the back door where the pool was, and I went out onto the lawn and found Abigail Folger. She was in a nightgown, and she'd been stabbed numerous times. Her gown was soaked in blood. Then, a little bit farther on, was Wojtek Frykowski. He had numerous head wounds, like he'd been hit with some kind of object. He also had many stab wounds and had been shot several times. He was fully clothed, and he was covered in blood. In the space of 10 minutes, I saw all 5 bodies. I'd worked homicide for 5 years and seen a lot of violence. This was the worst. Shortly after 11 a.m. on that Saturday, I got a call from my London office. Reuters was reporting that 5 people had been murdered in a private Hollywood enclave, and they were saying it was drug-related. I needed to get on the story fast. I checked the local city news service ticker tape for the address and raced the 15 miles over the canyons from my home in Studio City to Cielo Drive. By the time I arrived, it was already a crazy and hectic scene. TV cameras, radio, and print media had set up shop confined to the road leading up to the front gate. From time to time, LAPD media relations officer Dan Cook tried to answer questions without giving too much away. As news reporters arrived, they would get their information from the others. fact mixed in with heavy doses of fiction and speculation, not a regimen to guarantee journalistic accuracy. That first day, we got only sparse details about what had gone down and who the victims were. Outside the house, as bedlam grew, I recognized Hollywood gossip columnist Rona Barrett. "What are you doing here?" I inquired. "Have they got you covering the police beat now?" "Don't you know who lives at this house?" she asked, knowingly. And then she told me. I was shocked. I had interviewed Sharon Tate a couple of years earlier on the 20th Century Fox set of Valley of the Dolls, and she was a lovely lady. Based on Jacqueline Suzanne's best-selling novel, the movie had attracted an eclectic cast, including Susan Hayward, who stepped in when Judy Garland dropped out, and Oscar winner Patty Duke. Songs were penned by Dory and Andre Previn, with music by a then-unknown composer named John Williams. Raquel Welch, who had just come off Fantastic Voyage, was also to have starred, but Welch, or more likely her controlling husband-slash-manager Patrick Curtis, turned the role down, claiming that she didn't want to play sexpots anymore. So they offered the part of Jennifer North, the young actress with limited talent, to the sexy new girl on the block, Sharon Tate. We all knew that Tate's husband of 20 months was the hotshot director Roman Polanski. It didn't take a genius to realize that this story was not going to go away. In the early afternoon, with the temperature edging toward the 90s, as the increasingly large media army waited desperately for any actual facts to beef up the paucity of information, a forlorn-looking man stepped out of the guarded front gate. It was obvious he wasn't a cop because he wore white tennis shorts, tennis shoes, and a light sweater. "That's Roman's manager," Barrett whispered. It was, in fact, Bill Tennant, the 28-year-old Hollywood superagent who meticulously oversaw Polanski's career and had become close friends with his client and his wife. He'd been summoned from a Saturday morning game of tennis for the ugly task of identifying the bodies. As he walked out of the estate to climb into his car, his head was bowed and he was grim-faced and ashen. "Is it Sharon, Bill?" Barrett shouted to him. Tennant looked startled. "Oh, Rona," he snapped back angrily. "Don't be such an asshole." And he kept walking. Because the cops still weren't talking for the record, I spoke to several neighbors who were milling around to observe the media disruptions, but who were also both agitated and intrigued by the violence that had invaded their quiet, respectable community. Several filled me in, the best they could, confirming that the home's current occupants were indeed Polanski and Tate, and possibly a few other showbiz types staying with them. I was not alone in wrongly assuming that both Polanski and Tate had been killed. Details were sparse and rumors were rampant, although police did confirm that the body count stood at 5. But who exactly were they? Gradually, the names and the identities of the victims were revealed, and odd bits of information leaked out. Was it a drug murder? Yes, some drugs had been found at the scene. 3 ounces of marijuana, just over an ounce of hashish, a gram of cocaine and 10 capsules of MDA, a hallucinogenic drug. Some of it was found in Tate's bedroom, and some in a car belonging to her friend Sebring. But that still didn't explain why the mass murder. Did everyone go berserk during a bad acid drip? Was it a mafia hit? Had a drug deal gone bad? They even had a suspect, a drug-crazed teenager who was deeply involved in the peddling of LSD. How was he the only survivor? Satanism was tossed into the mix after one cop on the scene described the killings as ritualistic. That sort of made sense. Didn't Polanski direct Rosemary's Baby just a year before? A blood-stained American flag had been found, according to one reporter who was monitoring the police radio waveband in his car. What the heck could that mean? Sharon and Roman were said to be involved in the production of raunchy sex tapes. Drugs and orgies were rumored to be part and parcel of Sebring's lifestyle, which reportedly included sadomasochism. Another rumor was that the killers were wearing Ku Klux Klan garb, hence the hoods over some of the bodies. As was common practice on murder investigations, detectives deliberately withheld details about the precise way the victims died, and particularly the gruesome details of the carnage. But we soon learned the names of those who had perished atop the remote canyon. First identified was Tate, whom Polanski had met while he was casting the 1967 horror spoof The Fearless Vampire Killers, or Pardon Me, Your Teeth Are in My Neck. She was a beautiful, blonde 26-year-old actress, pegged as the next Marilyn Monroe. One of her bridesmaids at the high-profile wedding at the London Playboy Club in January 1968 was Canadian-born actress Barbara Parkins, whom she had met when they worked together on Valley of the Dolls. In the summer of 69, Tate put her career on hold to have a baby. She was just days away from delivering her first child, her son. In fact, a baby shower had been set for a few days later, and the day before violence struck, painters had put the finishing touches on the house's spare bedroom, turning it into a nursery. It later came out that Tate had been stabbed 16 times, and 5 of those wounds could have been fatal because they had penetrated her heart and lungs, causing massive hemorrhaging. She was dressed in a nightgown and had a rope tied around her neck, which had caused severe rope burns on her cheek. Polanski, we quickly learned, was not a victim, but at that very moment, heavily tranquilized on a jet flying back to Los Angeles from London, comforted by his good friend Warren Beatty. Also among the dead was the 35-year-old Sebring. He had been stabbed 7 times and shot once. Born Thomas John Cummer, his claim to Hollywood fame was that he had invented a new, more natural way of cutting men's hair, and he was well compensated for his technique. He charged $25 at a time when barbers were getting $1.50, and a tad more, $350, for celebrity toupees. He also extracted $2,500 a day plus expenses from the studios for on-set visits. The stars loved what he could do with a pair of scissors. His client list included the likes of Beatty, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, Kirk Douglas, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Jim Morrison of The Doors. Sebring had the reputation as a playboy, with a taste for beautiful women and kinky sex. He was also a former fiancé of Tate, and even when they broke up and she had married Polanski, Sebring stayed in the picture. Polanski was never jealous. In fact, he liked Sebring well enough to invite him to regularly hang out on Cielo Drive. The corpses on the lawn first spotted by Winnie Chapman included Frakowski, 32, who had been shot 4 times, stabbed 51 times, and had suffered 13 blows to his head with a blunt instrument. He was an old friend of Polanski's from Poland and a wannabe screenwriter with a penchant for hard drugs. He not only partook of them, but sold them on the side to make pocket money. He had no visible means of support and sponged off the generosity of his live-in girlfriend, Gibby Folger, the 25-year-old heiress to the famous coffee empire. Now her body lay a few feet away from his. She had been stabbed 28 times. Polanski had felt sorry for his Polish compatriot, inviting him and Folger to become near permanent guests at Cielo. Slumped over the wheel of the white Rambler in the driveway was Stephen Parent, an 18-year-old delivery boy who worked part-time in a Los Angeles stereo shop and who simply happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was visiting Garrettson, having stopped by late at night to try to sell him a radio. Hailing from the blue-collar Southern California neighborhood of El Monte, Parent's timing was tragic. He was at the wheel of his car and about to drive away when he was shot 3 times. I left the murder scene 3 times to call in my story to my editors in London, but I didn't have to go far to find a phone. I knew Cielo Drive. I had been there before. By a weird coincidence, a close friend actually lived on the street, a British friend who played for the same Los Angeles soccer team as I did, Philip Fried, an executive of Volkswagen of America, and his American wife, Joyce, had a home a few steps away at 10210. Fried was also able to confirm with absolute certainty that his neighbors were the Polanskis and that they were notorious partygoers and party throwers. The father of 2 young daughters, he told me there were frequent loud parties at the estate with music resounding throughout the canyon and scores of cars parked all the way down the long driveway, almost reaching Benedict Canyon. We never got invited, and they kept to themselves, he said. They did their own thing. This was not the kind of place where we had neighborhood block parties. In fact, it was a bit of a revolving door, lots of new faces. Many of the houses seemed to have new tenants every few weeks. Somewhat surprisingly, Fried did not know a huge criminal investigation was unfolding under his very nose until his brother-in-law showed up around 10:45 a.m. and told him that scores of media were milling around the Tate's driveway. That Saturday, around 9:30 a.m., I was trying to get a last-minute suntan at my pool because I was due to fly home to London on Tuesday to visit my mother, he told me. Suddenly, a whole bunch of police and TV helicopters were swooping low over my house. I thought they were going to attack me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?